Two very different Trumps today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Violence in Gaza didn't stop the ceremonies in Jerusalem today, celebrating the U.S. Embassy move and President Trump.
Without President Trump's determination, resolve, courage, we would not be here today.
We'll get a very different view of the president from the outgoing Economist bureau chief in Washington.
If you had to grow an American president who was likely to offend European public opinion in a kind of laboratory, you would come up with Donald Trump.
Plus, battling the bias against naturally curly hair in Egypt.
As a girl living in Egypt, everything that I saw in front of me sent this message that being beautiful means having straight hair.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us. And we begin in the Middle East, where two very contrasting events played out at almost exactly the same time today. Palestinian protesters gathered near the border between Israel and the Gaza Strip and began throwing rocks at the Israeli Defense Forces, who then fired back with live ammunition. This has been going on for more than 6 weeks now, but today's death toll is much higher. Meanwhile, not far from the Gaza Strip, this was happening in Jerusalem. With music and speeches, the United States officially opened its embassy in Jerusalem, formally recognizing the city as the capital of Israel. Matthew Bell is the world's religion reporter and joins me now in the studio. So you've been following the story for a while, Matthew. Today, such a day of stark contrast, violence and bloodshed on the border with Gaza, excitement and celebration just down the road in Jerusalem. What struck you about the news from Jerusalem?
I lived in Jerusalem reporting there for 3 years, and one thing I learned pretty quickly is that this conflict, this long-running conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, is never just about religion. It's about politics, it's about land, it's about resources, about power, but it is also about religion, especially when you're talking about Jerusalem, the holy city. The ceremony today at the new U.S. Embassy, which was the former consulate building, I watched the live stream of it. This went really big on religious issues. One of the Christian pastors that was there was Robert Jeffress. He's very close to Donald Trump. He's from a Dallas megachurch. Here's just a bit from his opening prayer.
Without President Trump's determination, resolve, courage, we would not be here today. And I believe, Father, I speak for every one of us when we say, we thank you every day that you have given us a president who boldly stands on the right side of history, but more importantly, stands on the right side of you, oh God, when it comes to Israel.
A very hearty endorsement of Donald Trump there. But I understand Robert Jeffress is a controversial figure.
He is. As I said, he's very close to Donald Trump and one of his most important evangelical advisors, a reminder of the evangelical support that Trump gets. But Jeffress has said some pretty harsh things about other faiths. He has said that Jews and Muslims are going to hell. He's even called the Catholic Church an instrument of Satan.
There's a lot of praise coming from the Israelis, not surprisingly, about this decision by Donald Trump to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Did that come through at the ceremony today?
Absolutely. Absolutely. From Israeli political leaders, from religious leaders. The truth is that for most Jews, Jerusalem has enormous significance. I talked with Miri Gold today. She's a Reform rabbi who lives on a kibbutz between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. She told me that if you ask almost any Jewish Israeli, they're going to tell you that Jerusalem is not just the nation's capital, but it's the center of the universe for Jewish life. At the same time, Gold says it's hard for her to be fully joyful about this U.S. embassy move, and that's because of what else is happening in the region, as we talked about.
I think it's hard to rejoice knowing that there are parts of our population who are not happy about this, because they want to also feel a certain sovereignty that gives recognition to the fact that Jerusalem is their capital as well, for both Islam and for Christianity. And we're not there yet. So the joy is tempered by the realpolitik, I think, to a great extent.
Rabbi Miri Gold expressing her feelings there. And Matthew, when it comes to Palestinians, their leaders today, angry and saddened by the deaths in Gaza. They're also angry by Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. What have we heard from them?
The Palestinian Authority in the West Bank said that the Israeli military was carrying out a massacre in Gaza. The Islamist group Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, said that Jerusalem is a red line. They said the U.S. embassy move is an attack on our people's right to their land. I talked with Maha Nassar today. She's a professor at the University of Arizona. She explained to me how Jerusalem is holy for Muslims because it's where they believe that Prophet Muhammad ascended into heaven. About the U.S. embassy move, Nassar said that it's probably more symbolic than substantive in the short term, but it is, she said, going to have an impact.
It sends a message to Palestinians everywhere that the U.S. disregards Palestinian claims to the land, claims to the city, claims to the holy sites. And I think it's proving once and for all that the U.S. is not an honest broker in issues related to Israel-Palestine, and that we're going to have to look elsewhere for leadership on this issue.
And Marco, Trump administration officials, they said it again today, that they are committed to a peace process. But at this point, it's pretty hard to see what that process looks like.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Marco.
When the U.S. finds itself in the middle of any crisis, we often turn to David Rennie from The Economist to put things in perspective for us. For the past 6 years, David has been based in Washington for the paper, watching America and thinking a lot about its place in the world.
It's been a real kind of journey, I think, for the rest of the world, for America's enemies and for America's friends.
Rennie wrote the popular Lexington column and became The Economist bureau chief. Now they're sending him to Beijing, so I asked him to unpack what he's witnessed in the last 6 years and the world he found just as Barack Obama was starting his second term.
There was a sense that America was getting the thin end of the wedge in a way, that America was paying all of the costs of being the global policeman while others were free riders. So here's the difference. I think if the Obama-era message was that the rest of the world had to grow up and that somehow America being willing to do all of the security had almost kind of infantilized the international system, that others were too used to America being the kind of the nanny, the global policeman. So that was kind of the Obama message was grow up. The Trump message is pay up. You know, he's much more transactional. He has much less interest in the international system being in good shape. He has much, much less interest in the rules-based order. It's not that he wants everyone else to play their role in supporting the rules-based order. He despises the rules-based order. He thinks it should be America out for itself, and others, if they have money, should be paying for their own defense. And if America just pulls back and the rules-based order, you know, gets a lot less kind of orderly and a lot more chaotic, then tough. You know, it's not America's job.
So put on your bowler hat now and talk as the Brit that you are. How is America regarded today by the Brits and other Europeans?
It's not good. I mean, if you had to grow an American president who was likely to offend European public opinion in a kind of laboratory, you would come up with Donald Trump. I mean, basically every sort of negative cliche about Americans, wealthy Americans who don't seem to know much or care much about the outside world, who are kind of bullies, who are swaggering, you know, that was Donald Trump on the campaign program. I mean, remember my first posting in the United States was during the Iraq War invasion era. I was here from 2002 to 2005.
Yeah.
Remember the protest banners that Europeans used to carry around cities like London or Paris back then? They would accuse George W. Bush of not actually caring about human rights, only wanting to take the foreigners' oil. They would accuse George W. Bush of wanting to torture Muslims because he just didn't like Muslims very much. And those were often grotesque caricatures of George W. Bush's policies. That was Donald Trump's campaign pitch, was take the oil, don't care about human rights, and torture Muslims. Wouldn't that be a good idea?
Right.
So, you know, that was pretty bad. I think now there's a real sense of alarm in Western capitals that we're seeing kind of second year Trump is somewhere closer to the kind of instinctive Trump, the real Trump, if you like. And that they're finding very, very hard to deal with.
I mean, by many standards, American power is in decline. Its share of the world's economy, even its share of world population, have been trending downward for decades. What do you think? Is the pendulum just swinging, or are we looking at kind of permanent changes?
Smart people who I talk to in other governments say it depends whether there's one or two terms of Donald Trump. They're pretty sure that the international system would reset after one term of Donald Trump. Two terms? They're not so sure. I think one big thing that may have changed really durably under Donald Trump, and this slightly worries me, particularly as I'm heading to China, so I'm thinking a lot about Asia at the moment, is for decades in Asia, one of the strengths that America had was it was predictable because you could see that America had certain fairly fixed interests. It liked to have open seas for merchant shipping to go freely across the Pacific. It wanted to have a rules-based order. It wanted to have free trade. It wanted to promote human rights and democracy because it thought that those countries were likelier to be easy to deal with. It wanted to have open markets. So America's interests were so kind of fixed and predictable that it didn't always matter if there was a Republican in the White House or a Democrat in the White House, that allies understood that American troops would always be in Japan, they would always be in South Korea, that the American fleet would always be guaranteeing those open sea lanes for shipping because America's interests were so predictable and fixed. Donald Trump has made America a lot less predictable, and that's one of the things that his supporters love him for. But I think that in Asia, the idea that America's interests are not so fixed and so predictable that maybe you could have an American president who pulls all the troops out of Japan or South Korea or who cedes the South China Sea to China for some other advantage. That degree of unpredictability, I think that has really lasting consequences.
What would you say are America's biggest strengths and weaknesses right now, as we sit here in 2018?
Well, you don't just have to ask me. You have to, you know, I can quote senior Americans who I have traveled with. You know, I've been lucky enough as the Economist guy here, I've traveled with three different secretaries of defense around the whole world. I've traveled with the Secretary of State. I've traveled with the Vice President. You know, I've done a lot of these trips. And one of the consistent things that big American figures, when they travel overseas, they say, particularly in a place like Asia, is America's greatest strength isn't actually its aircraft carriers and its nuclear weapons. America's greatest strength, particularly in a competition with rising powers like China, is that America has allies. China has business partners. China has clients. China has kind of tributary kingdoms nearby that grudgingly, you know, allow China to sort of set the rules. But America has allies. It has treaty alliances that go way back to World War II. And the idea that America was the guarantor of a post-war order, which was built on American generosity, because that was a long-term bet that making the world free and friendly and prosperous was in America's overwhelming interest because America got to write the rules. That is really in doubt now.
So does that mean that America's biggest weakness right now is that we're frittering away those allies?
Yeah, look at the trade fight that could be about to break out later this month with China. America is picking fights with its allies as it picks a fight with China, and that's very hard to see the logic of why they're doing that.
So as you get set to do your work now in Beijing, I know you've gone several times to get ready for your move there. What is your sense of how America is viewed in China right now?
So it's also my second posting in China, although I was there a long time ago. So China's changed a lot. But I've spent a lot of time trying to talk to Chinese business figures, Chinese officials. They don't really have a handle on where he thinks this trade fight is going to go. China is ready to do a deal in some ways on trying to change the trading relationship between America and China. But the big complaint that you hear all of the time right now is the Americans haven't even made clear what they want. They're asking for so many things, some of which are contradictory. We need to know what America wants, and then we can really negotiate. So there's a sense that Donald Trump's unpredictability, which is his proudest boast, is making the Chinese very unclear how to deal with him in a way that kind of gets us out of this trade war that would be so damaging for both sides.
What are you most excited about covering and writing about?
I think that the China that is just kind of showing its hand right now has ambitions. We always knew that kind of China growing up and becoming strong and open to the world was going to be a gigantic story. But this China under Xi Jinping is showing its hand and openly expressing ambitions to be, you know, the leading economy in some ways by mid-century. That is the story of the 21st century. So although this story covering Donald Trump in Washington is probably the most exciting story, I do think that the China story is the biggest story of the century, and people will be writing history books about this for a long time to come. So the chance to try and watch that on the ground is pretty amazing.
David Rennie of The Economist will be checking back in with you when you are in Beijing, and thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Let me take you back to May 1985.
One of the most devastating military spy rings since the war has just been smashed in the United States. The damage is enormous. The ringleader has betrayed British and NATO secrets as well.
The spies in that spy ring, all from the same American family. They were accused of selling top-secret U.S. Navy documents to the Soviet Union. If you don't remember this episode, that's okay. It's one of the great things about having the BBC as a partner, their enormous archive of sound. So for the BBC History Program Witness, my colleague Dina Newman dug into the story of the man at the center of this extraordinary tale.
The alleged ringleader was a former Navy officer, John Walker, who specialized in top-secret naval communications work. He had access to vitally important information regarding NATO submarine warfare.
Then U.S. and NATO submarines have been compromised in the highly secret area of communication systems. They include some secret ciphers, intelligence-gathering methods, and anti-submarine warfare tactics. The technology of submarine design, and information on large, although not specific, submarine patrol areas.
By the time he was arrested, John Walker had been spying for the USSR for nearly 20 years and was living a lifestyle way beyond the means of your average retired naval officer. Known for his ultra-right views, it was clear that money, rather than ideology, was his main motivation for spying. In fact, as a CIA expert told the BBC at the time, the Soviets had no problem recruiting agents among right-wing capitalist-minded Americans, people like John Walker.
The Russians are used to this. They feel much more comfortable dealing with a right-wing agent than a left-wing agent. They don't have to make a lot of silly explanations to the right-wing agent about what a great place the Soviet Union is, where they have to worry about it.
How do you then account for the fact that you're a communist and he's a super patriot and capitalist?
I'd say, look, we're the side that's going to win. You can see how easy it is to stick your hands in the marshmallow of the United States and get anything out. How can a country like this possibly defend itself against good, hard, tough guys like us? And since we're going to win, you'd be on the winning side. We'll remember you when we win. In the meantime, we give you money. Go off and indulge your fantasies.
Not only did John Walker indulge his own fantasies, he also recruited his son, Michael Walker, who also served in the U.S. Navy, and a family friend, Jerry Whitworth, who worked in top-secret Navy communications. It seems that John also recruited his elder brother Arthur, a former anti-submarine warfare instructor. Sam Meekins was Arthur's attorney, and he heard the story of Arthur's recruitment when he interviewed his client in prison.
John apparently approached him on several occasions, and Arthur's typical response was, "I don't have anything, John. I don't have anything. Nothing's valuable here." In order to convince John that he didn't have anything of value, he produced some documents that are called casualty reports, or CASREPs, gave them to John, and that was his involvement.
John Walker certainly worked hard to recruit people to his spy ring. His daughter Laura remembers the pressure she was under when she worked for the military.
First he'd break you down and make you feel like the lowest form of life. He'd say, you know you're never going to be successful. You know you can't do anything with your life. You're not a very bright person. Why don't you let me help you make a lot of money? You're just never going to make it in this world. Don't you understand that? You're just not anybody special. But I've got a way of helping you to earn a great deal of money. You're never going to get anywhere unless you do things my way. So he would break you down. He'd break your spirit down.
With Laura, John's methods didn't work. But it seems that Arthur, a shy and retiring man, simply couldn't resist this kind of pressure from his younger brother.
I would say Arthur would be the wallpaper in a room. You could walk in a room of people, you wouldn't notice Arthur. He was diminutive in size, I mean, slight build, balding, glasses, not loud. In my experience with him, meek.
But if Arthur couldn't resist his own brother, he seemed even more clueless in his dealings with the FBI.
He was interviewed by the FBI in 1985 when the story broke, several times. He never got counsel.
So why do you think he didn't ask for a lawyer?
That's part of the enigma of Arthur to me. I mean, he wasn't unintelligent. He was a rational man. I don't know why, when he's confronted by the FBI with some of the things that they talked to him about, why he wouldn't seek counsel, but he never did. I think His explanation was always that he didn't think he had done anything wrong. He knew he had maybe made a mistake.
How did you feel when you finally got his testimonies? Were you left shaking your head as you looked at them?
Yes, absolutely.
The question is, was Arthur Walker so naive that he first committed a serious crime under pressure from his brother and then incriminated himself to the hilt with the FBI?
Either he was exceptionally naive or he was exceptionally sly.
If Arthur's own lawyer was unconvinced, so was the FBI. They always thought that Arthur knew more than he ever said. In fact, they strongly suspected that Arthur was the first to contact the Soviets before John did.
They never really believed the way John said he got started. John said he got started by sitting in his car outside of the Russian embassy for 3 or 4 days in a row, and finally some guy from the embassy walked out and talked to him, and that's how he got hooked up with the Russians to give them secrets. The FBI would tell you they have the Russian embassy under surveillance 24 hours a day, and nobody ever sat out there for 4 days in a row and got contacted. Of course, they didn't know when it was either, but they never believed that story. What I believe they believe is that Arthur's the one that got this started, decided he didn't want to do it, turned it over to John, and then John went back to him in the 80s.
Whatever the real story behind Arthur's involvement, he could never persuade his FBI interrogators that he was what he seemed to be, an exceptionally naive man, unable to stand up to his younger brother.
One of the reasons they thought that is he could never pass a polygraph. And the thing he couldn't pass a polygraph on, the question he could never pass a polygraph on, was prior to 1980, did he ever meet and talk with a Soviet agent? And he would fail that question every time.
And so Arthur Walker dug himself in deeper and deeper. Not only did he never manage to convince the FBI that he wasn't lying, he couldn't even enter a plea bargain, insisting he'd already told everything he knew and had nothing to bargain with. At his trial, it took the judge 16 minutes to convict him for espionage. Arthur's first question to his astonished attorney was, "What do you think, maybe a suspended sentence? I won't have to go to prison, will I?" Instead, he got 3 life sentences plus 40 years.
He was pounded. There's no doubt about it. And I did everything I could do for the guy. I worked my tail off for a year and a half. I just could never make a dent. He was going to be the example, and he was. They were never fully satisfied that Arthur told the truth. I can go in circles trying to figure out who he really was. He never once complained. He never wrote me a letter from prison that I don't belong here. He never blamed me for being convicted. He just took it like a man.
John Walker got a life sentence but entered a plea bargain in exchange for a reduced sentence for his son Michael. Both John and Arthur Walker died in prison, while Michael, who had a minor role in the spy ring, was released on parole in 2000. Jerry Whitworth is still in jail.
My colleague Dina Newman there reporting for the BBC's Witness program. I'm Marco Werman. Seasonal workers are key for business owners on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and it's a challenge to recruit them locally.
We have to advertise extensively. I've had maybe 5 or 6 people apply in 17 years.
But getting enough visas for foreign seasonal workers isn't easy either. Our story from Cape Cod, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Some disturbing news out of the Democratic Republic of Congo last week. The World Health Organization confirmed that Ebola is back. Since last month, 30 possible cases of the virus have been reported in the DRC. International organizations and healthcare workers are moving fast to try to prevent an outbreak like the one that affected thousands of people in West Africa in 2014 and 15. Helen Branswell is the infectious diseases reporter for STAT, which focuses on health and medicine reporting. So just to be clear, Helen, I'm saying outbreak, but as of right now, it's still quite small, right? Do we know how many deaths have been confirmed in the DRC as a result of Ebola?
So at this point, it is small when you're thinking about the context of the 2014 West African outbreak, but that was an anomaly, more than 10 times bigger than all previous Ebola outbreaks combined. But this one seems to be getting off to a fairly decent start. The WHO has said this morning that they think there may be 39 cases already, and 19 of those people have died. We tend to think it is much more dramatic than it is. In fact, there are other diseases in that part of the world that can manifest with symptoms that are quite similar to Ebola. So it generally takes a while before locations realize that what they're dealing with is not, for instance, severe malaria, but actually Ebola.
And the strain that we're talking about right now in DR Congo, is it the same strain of Ebola that hit West Africa in 2014?
Yeah, that's correct. It's the Ebola Zaire virus. And that's good news in this case, because there is a vaccine that targets the Ebola Zaire virus. It's still an experimental vaccine. It's being developed by the drug company Merck. But it actually has been tested in West Africa, and there are data that suggest it's very effective.
Do you know if that experimental vaccine is going to be deployed in DR Congo as a result of this outbreak?
Yes, it will be deployed. I was talking to the Director General of the WHO yesterday, Dr. Tedros, and he said that DRC has asked for the vaccine. Right now, they are putting in place what's called the cold chain. It needs to be stored at minus 60 to minus 80 Celsius. So wow. You can imagine that's a challenge in a part of the world where there isn't a lot of electricity or consistent electricity. So they've been moving in freezers and generators. And he said they'll be hoping to start the vaccination campaign before the end of the week. I should note, it's not a mass vaccination campaign. What they plan to do is what's called ring vaccination, where if you find a case, you find out who's been in contact with that person, and you vaccinate all those people. It's the approach that was used to eradicate smallpox.
Helen, where is this outbreak actually happening in DR Congo, and what is the likelihood that it could reach a major city and spread even more rapidly?
As we said before, Congo's had a lot of outbreaks, and they know how to contain Ebola, and typically they've occurred in very remote areas. That's been a blessing and a curse because, you know, on the one hand, it makes it very hard to get in there with response teams and the equipment you need to contain an outbreak. But on the other hand, those outbreaks can be contained. This time, the epicenter is in a kind of remote part of western DRC, a place called Bokoro, and it's on a lake. And that lake feeds into the Congo and Ubangi rivers, which are major tributaries that lead to Kinshasa, which has a population of over 11 million people, and Brazzaville, capital of the Republic of Congo. So there really is a possibility of getting cases into large urban settings.
Well, you were on the phone with the World Health Organization yesterday. What are the biggest concerns for WHO officials and other experts right now about this particular outbreak? Would you say generally they feel more prepared to fight Ebola this time around?
You know, I think it's really clear that they've learned lessons from 2014. The response to this outbreak has been really rapid. I mean, it's not yet a week since the Democratic Republic of the Congo announced that they had Ebola. And the WHO Director General has been at the epicenter. He flew back to Geneva last night. That speaks volumes about how seriously they're taking this. All sorts of partners are on the ground. There are now Doctors Without Borders, the International Federation of the Red Cross. I mean, the players that need to be involved are there, and everybody is taking this really seriously.
Helen Branswell, the infectious diseases reporter for STAT here in Boston. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's sneaking up on summer here in New England, slowly. But for our neighbors on Cape Cod, summer means lots of visitors. Last summer was tough for restaurants, hotels, and tourist shops on the Cape. They couldn't find enough seasonal workers. Most businesses there rely on foreign workers who come to the U.S. on H-2B visas, temporary non-immigrant visas given out to seasonal workers. The U.S. government only issues 33,000 of them, that's for the entire nation, each year for summertime workers. And with record demand, even that's proving to be not nearly enough. And this year might be shaping up to be harder than last year. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
The Hot Chocolate Sparrow is a popular spot in the beach town of Orleans. For 16 years, they've been serving up more than just coffee.
Yeah, we do coffee, espresso, sandwiches, breakfast, chocolate, candy, ice cream fraps.
Fraps is New England speak for milkshakes. Owner Perry Sparrow has 80 employees in summer, a mix of locals, college students, and eight folks on H-2B visas. Sparrow has to post his jobs here first to try and hire Americans. If he can't find enough, which he says he never can, he gets the same workers each year from Jamaica and the Philippines.
And they can, you know, crank out these sandwiches like clockwork.
But last year, they didn't arrive until after Labor Day. It was basically too late.
So yeah, it causes, you know, longer lines, definitely slower service. All the things you might expect.
This year, he has no idea when his foreign workers might get here. Federal labor officials received 81,000 seasonal visa applications in January from across the country. Immigration officials are only handing out 33,000. The Trump administration set up a lottery.
We didn't win the lottery, so we're still waiting on the visa cap to be lifted.
But Congress did lift the cap for this year back in March as part of a spending bill. That doubled the amount of H-2B visas available for the season. But the Department of Homeland Security hasn't yet released those extra visas. Democratic Congressman Bill Keating, who represents the Cape, says during times of high demand in the Bush and Obama administrations, the solutions were straightforward.
What's happened, with the Trump administration is a change in this policy, a change that empowered the Secretary of Homeland Security to have final authority.
U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the part of DHS that oversees the visas, declined an interview request. Keating and others are waiting to find out when the extra visas will be released. Keating says this delay could hurt President Trump's resorts as well.
And there's an irony there. His facilities liberally use the H-2B visas.
Keating is part of a coalition of 89 members in Congress now fighting the White House on the visa delay.
Why are they making it so difficult? Yeah, why are they resting all this with the Department of Homeland Security, really making it an immigration issue when it's truly a small business issue?
McGregor Hay, who owns Max Seafood, put things more bluntly.
You know, at its core, it's really, this is part of what people are afraid of, the browning of America.
We sat at the outside tables at Max Shack near the water in the town of Wellfleet. Hay's restaurant is pretty empty now, but you can wait hours for a table during August. Hay hires about 300 people to work at his establishments each year, perhaps 70 on H-2B visas. He's fed up with people who say this doesn't put Americans first. He says he can't find enough Americans.
We have to advertise extensively. I've had maybe 5 or 6 people apply in 17 years.
Hay says he recruited in Puerto Rico this year as well. He only got 2 workers. It would have been easier to hire Puerto Ricans who are Americans. Hiring foreign workers costs him more money. Each year when he fills out the paperwork and pays for flights to bring his workers from across the globe, he says he's shelling out at least an extra $100,000.
And everyone says, well, just raise the wages that you pay your employees. That is not a solution because our wages are already high. Put it this way, if I can find someone that wants to relocate to this community, into our restaurants, into our business for, you know, anywhere from the $16 to $20 hour range, then hit me up, send me an email. We've got a spot for you.
If he doesn't get those emails, he's in trouble. The H-2B visa crunch this year is even tighter because of a rule change 2 years ago. Returning workers used to be exempt from the visa cap. That way, businesses could be guaranteed to bring back the same workers year after year. And it also freed up more visas. Congress let the exemption expire back in 2016. Hay is fed up with the way the policies are stigmatizing foreign workers.
These are human beings. These are people with feelings, emotions, families, goals, aspirations.
Hay took me back into the kitchen to talk to some of the guys, like Ansel Mathewson from Jamaica, who was slicing potatoes. He's been coming to Max for 5 years.
Wonderful place to work, you know, great food, great vibe, working with the Mexicans. Best place to be, you know?
Mathewson wants to go to culinary school and eventually own his own place in Jamaica. He says working on the Cape is good experience and good money, and he feels lucky to have gotten a visa this year.
Yes, I have a lot of friends back in Jamaica. Didn't get the opportunity to come here, you know, so it's kind of sad, but it is what it is.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Wellfleet, Massachusetts.
It looks like an ordinary scene on cable news, a male and a female anchor reading the headlines, both standing in front of video images from that day's big stories. But there is one oddity. The woman is wearing glasses. And in South Korea, where this took place, that decision has caused a social media storm. Lim Hyun-ju is a news anchor, and like many female journalists in Korean media, she had always worn contact lenses on camera. But she said she wanted to change that. My colleague at BBC Korean, Soo-min Hwang, has been following the story. Why is this such a big deal in Korea?
It gained a lot of attention because it's so rare to see a woman in glasses, especially in media. Especially in news, you see a very pretty, young, pretty woman standing next to a middle-aged male. And often they are paraded as like this little pretty figure that adds to the male voice of authority. And there's a lot of social pressure to look pretty, and it's just not a done thing to wear glasses, especially on screen.
So this news anchor, Lim Hyun-ju, I mean, she said she wanted to change this whole kind of attitude about women. What more can you tell us about why she did this?
Her motivation is also quite interesting, because she also said that she made the decision because in order to present the morning news, she had to wake up at 2:40 a.m. every single morning, have the makeup done, get her false eyelashes, and it was just so tiring for her to wear contact lenses. So when she started wearing glasses to protect her eyes, a lot of both male and female audiences responded so positively to this new change. And a lot of people also praised her for her bravery, and I quote, that this is a very brave attempt to wear glasses on screen.
I got to say, it sounds a little like a debate that's been happening in the U.S., the exasperation among some women about how their appearance somehow says something about their ability to do their jobs. Like, even in the media, in 2010, Christiane Amanpour from CNN, she stepped in to host This Week on ABC and was wearing glasses. And some viewers took note, either because they didn't like it or because they thought glasses gave her credibility. Would you say there's a similarity in those debates?
I would say so. A woman not wearing glasses does not just extend to journalism, but also entertainment industry and the soap opera industry, where all the women there are very, very highly groomed and looking very, very pretty.
As a Korean journalist yourself, Soo-min, have you ever felt this kind of pressure? Like, did anyone ever suggest that your journalism would be improved if you changed the way you look?
I used to wear glasses, and then I got LASIK surgery, so I got my eyesight corrected. I would use glasses to project certain kind of, so if I was going somewhere and I wanted to make a kind of intelligent, know-it-all kind of impression, then I would actually wear glasses. And when I would be out socially, then I would definitely wear contact lenses.
Have you ever been to a job interview where, wearing glasses might have been seen as a deal breaker for you?
I have actually thought about it, and I do remember whenever I would go to job interviews, I would ask my mom, glasses or no glasses? And depending on the job title, I would sometimes choose to wear glasses if it was something more bookish, kind of intelligent type of job, or if it was a role that didn't require much of that intelligence using, then I would wear contact lenses.
And what would your mom typically advise? I mean, is this a generational thing too?
I think she actually sometimes would recommend using glasses. Huh. Well, I can speak for myself only, but it really changed how I felt about myself. And that's why I would actively choose not to wear glasses and wear contact lenses instead when I'm going out.
So you put on glasses, you look in the mirror. What do you see?
I would feel very geekish in a very negative way. And I did feel very unattractive. And if I'm dressing up, wearing something very nice, I would definitely not wear glasses with it because I felt it doesn't go with how I look.
Soo-min, how much is there kind of a real push, a real campaign by Korean women to change this? I mean, is this kind of a watershed moment, the fact that Lim Hyun-ju has kind of stepped out and said, I'm wearing glasses?
I actually think there is a long way to go for the Korean society to break out of that gender stereotypes. So I think women also have to change that. They also have to feel confident about themselves, and they Korean society as a whole be a society where people are not judged by what they look like.
My colleague Soo-min Hwang at BBC Korean, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Curly hair is beautiful. And that may not sound like an especially revolutionary or bold statement, but it is for many women in Egypt. That's because they've been told all their lives to straighten their naturally curly hair. by perfect strangers sometimes. But that societal stigma against curly hair seems to be easing up now. My BBC colleague Dina Abu-Ghazala has been writing about that. So, Dina, you wrote a story recently that basically is stating that curly hair is making a comeback in Egypt. I want to find out more about that, but tell us about the stigma first. Why have Egyptian women been pressured for so long to straighten their hair?
Well, I don't know why historically this happened, but I can tell you that at least since I became conscious of my existence as a woman being raised in Egypt, I grew up to know that being beautiful, meaning having straight hair, and if, you know, blonde even, if that would be better. So almost everything that we Egyptian women do not have, because Egypt, after all, lies in Africa. And having this sort of dark skin, curly hair is the dominant feature, really. So as a girl living in Egypt, everything that I saw in front of me sent this message that being beautiful means having straight hair. So I would turn on the TV and see the commercials. They are all selling products for straight hair. You would see even the models used for these commercials having straight hair. Soap operas or movies or the actresses, celebrities have straight hair. Whenever there is a big event, you know, if we have a wedding in the family or it's just even a party, it's a no-brainer for, you know, my parents and me to take me to the hairdresser to straighten my hair.
Does it extend to the workplace? I mean, it's not just a family thing, but do you find kind of pressure in an office?
Yeah, well, one of the girls I interviewed actually reached the point where she decided to leave the country because of this kind of pressure. She tells me that for the first couple of months of her working in an Egyptian bank, someone from HR would come to her and ask her to straighten her hair because her appearance is inappropriate.
Wow. And she left Egypt because the pressure got too much?
Yes. I know it does sound extreme. I think for every one of us, we're different. We react to things differently. And each and every one of us has a different breaking point. For her, this was a breaking point. She has this big, thick hair, curly, very curly hair. And every time she goes out of the house, she walks in the streets, someone, some way or another, has to comment on her hair. And she reached the point when she was so fed up and she couldn't take this anymore. And then she traveled to Spain. And for the first time of her life, she walked in the streets and no one commented on her hair.
Wow.
For the first time, she didn't have to prepare herself for the comments she will hear. And if she ever heard comments there in Spain, they were actually positive comments.
But as you've been writing, it sounds like things are changing in Egypt.
Exactly. It all started with the creation of a Facebook group called The Hair Addict. So the one who launched the group was actually mocked for her hair as a child and also went through this phase of having to straighten her hair constantly. So she said that while doing this, while straightening her hair, she started, you know, researching about how to be able to protect her hair from the side effects or the damage that will happen as a result of this constant heating. And over the years, she accumulated this wealth of knowledge. And she decided, I can actually share this knowledge with other people. So she launched this group.
Wow.
And this group started growing, 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 until now it has more than 105,000 female members.
Are it's you a member?
Group. Yes, I am. Indeed.
What kind of things do people post on the Facebook group?
Simple tips, like, for example, my biggest, I know this sounds completely trivial, but my biggest problem, for example, was how to keep my curls while sleeping. Yeah. So I would have a very nice, you know, I would take a shower and have a very nice curly hair and then go to sleep and wake up with my hair completely looking different.
Well, I would guess that after a life of being told you need straight hair and trying to straighten your hair, suddenly having your natural curly hair is almost a new thing.
Yeah. And tips like this, you know, simple tips. But I have to say what really set this trend and made it a pattern is the heat-free challenge. Because they said, okay, we keep sharing all these tips and natural remedies, whatever. But then women would go to the hairdresser and straighten their hair. And then again, it gets damaged. So we keep moving in a vicious circle. So in order to stop this, we really need to embrace our natural hair. That's it. Do not straighten it. And then they started posting pictures of themselves, like day one heat free, I don't know, day 100 heat free, you know, going all natural and the difference. And people started, you know, pictures are a very powerful tool. So people started seeing the pictures and saying, oh, this actually is possible. We can do this.
Mm. Big changes. So is this a case of women just having had enough and forcing a change, or are Egyptian men also getting on board with this?
No, I'd say this is a movement led by women.
Right.
The reaction from men is it differs. The biggest, negative reaction would come from the older people. I think this is a big change for the older generation. So some people would tell me, especially mothers who have children, tell that the grandparents of these children would tell them, why don't you just, you know, brush her hair properly? Why are you leaving it like that? They're not used to the idea of like, her hair is curly. You leave it curly.
I'm guessing there's no turning back with this now. It's not like there's going to be, you know, more straight hair kind of challenging the rebirth of curly hair.
Yeah, I think exactly. Women started something. And the way I see it is that it's not just about curly hair. It's about your choice. You do whatever you want to do. Mm. I think the message is there is no one way. I mean, you can be whatever you want to be. But the point is that you want to be. So I think this is the point, just liberating you from everything that anyone tells you. It's we're giving you the information. You make decisions for yourself. You decide either, yes, I want to go down that route and take care of my hair naturally. Or guess what? Yes, I know this, but I like how I look with my straightened hair. Go ahead and do it. It's your choice.
I think of the famous Egyptian soccer star Mohamed Salah, who has curly hair, but I'm guessing Egyptian men don't face the same pressures.
Definitely. As a man, it's fine. the pressure to look in a certain way is, of course, you cannot compare it. There is no comparison between the pressure on women and the pressure on men.
The BBC's Dina Abu Ghazala telling us about the curly hair comeback happening in Egypt. Thank you, Dina.
You're welcome.
My conversation with Dina comes courtesy of our Across Women's Lives desk. You can check out more of our coverage of global women's issues at PRI.org or on Facebook at Across Women's Lives. And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.